You are listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
It's 8 p.m. in Israel on Thursday, the 18th of April. In the headlines, Washington reportedly agrees to an Israeli operation in Rafah under certain conditions if Israel does not strike Iran. Tehran threatens to renew its nuclear doctrine. Washington and London impose new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. is expected to veto a U.N. Security Council resolution tonight, recognizing Palestine as a U.N. member state. Qatar says it is reassessing its role as a mediator between Israel and Hamas. Hamas says it has not pulled out of the talks. And the weather, seasonal tomorrow. Good evening, this is Mark Weiss with the news. Amid concerns of a regional escalation following Iran's drone and missile attacks on Israel, the American administration has reportedly agreed to an Israeli military operation in Rafah, in the south of the Gaza Strip, on condition Israel does not carry out a broad counterstrike against Iran. Egyptian sources told the Al Arabi Al Jadid newspaper that Egyptian forces in northern Sinai are on a full state of alert along the border with the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the American network ABC reports that Israel planned to respond to the Iranian attack and twice cancelled it this week. American sources told the network that an Israeli attack on Iran is not expected to take place until after Passover. A Khan reporter says that the war cabinet considered a number of options for a response, including hitting Iran's proxies in the region and a cyber attack. The New York Times reports today that Israel miscalculated the scope and scale of the Iranian response to the killing of several Revolutionary Guard officers in its April 1st strike in Damascus that Tehran blames on Israel. Israeli officials were quoted by the paper as saying Israel did not see a strike on an Iranian target in Syria as a provocation and did not give Washington a heads up about it until right before it happened. According to the report, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin complained directly to his Israeli counterpart Yoav Gallant in a phone call after the strike that it put, claiming it put U.S. forces in the region at risk. Two Israeli sources said planning of the strike in Damascus began about 2 months ago. According to the report, the operation was authorized by the War Cabinet a week beforehand. Iran could review its nuclear doctrine amid Israeli threats, a senior Iranian Revolutionary Guards commander said on Thursday, according to the semi-official Tasnim news agency, raising concerns about Tehran's nuclear program, which it has always said was strictly for peaceful purposes. Israel's ambassador to the United States, Mike Herzog, says it is important to push back against Iran. In an interview with the Fox network, Herzog said the defense is not enough to create deterrence.
In our part of the world, defense is not enough to create deterrence. We need to push back. And the main message, the main lesson from what happened the other day when Iran attacked us is that all of us have to enhance deterrence vis-a-vis Iran. I'll tell you one more thing. If we do not push back against Iran, in a matter of few years, you may see nuclear warheads on ballistic missiles, Iranian ballistic missiles. So we all have to draw the lessons. And the lesson is to push back and enhance deterrence vis-a-vis Iran.
Israel's ambassador to the United States, Mike Herzog. Retired Brigadier General Tzvika Haimovich, a former commander of the Israel Air Defences, said that Israel's air defences were less sophisticated. Said that Iran's air defences were less sophisticated than their missile and drone systems, and its air force was poorly outdated to deal with any incoming threats. He was speaking at a briefing organised by the government.
The air defence capabilities in Iran, they are less sophisticated than the long-range missile capabilities and the UAVs capabilities. The classical air force in Iran is in a very poor condition, maintenance, and all the platforms. And the air defense forces Most of their defense forces, they are Russian, of course, batteries or capabilities. Most of them, they are very, very old version, the SA-5, which called the S-200. They are very old. The new version, the S-300, I know that they have ambitions to buy the S-400. This is the newest system that the Russians are developing the last decade or so on. As I know, there is no S-400 in Iran itself. Maybe in the last few days we will find ourselves with this system on the ground in Iran. But, and this is the big but, the Israeli Air Force dealt with this Russian system, the S-200, the S-300, and also the S-400 in Syria, when Russia deployed forces in late 15 to Syria. They brought also these capabilities. So our Air Force and the coalition's Air Forces, they flew in this environment. They know how to deal effectively with this system. It again, I'll give them the respect, but I think that that will not be the main challenge dealing with Iran. They have a lot of systems. Most of them, they are very old. I think that they are not so effective and efficient. It's not zero, but it's not 100%.
Retired Brigadier General Tzvika Chaimovich, a former commander of the Israeli defenses. The United States on Thursday announced new sanctions on Iran, targeting its unarmed aerial vehicle production after its missile and drone strike on Israel last weekend. The U.S. Treasury Department statement said that the measures targeted 16 individuals and two entities enabling Iran's drone production, including engine types that power Iran's Shahad variant UAVs, which were used in the April the 13th attack. Treasury said it was also designating five companies in multiple jurisdictions providing component materials for steel production to Iran's steel company KSC. The U.S. statement came after finance ministers and central bank governors of the group of seven industrial democracies said after a meeting on Wednesday that they would ensure close coordination of any future measure to diminish Iran's ability to acquire, produce, or transfer weapons to support destabilizing regional activities. Britain has placed sanctions on Iranian military entities, including the General Staff of the Armed Forces and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy. The measures follow Iran's missile and drone attack last weekend. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said on Monday the group of seven nations was working on a package of coordinated measures against Iran. The British sanctions targeted 13 entities or individuals in total. Foreign Minister Yisrael Katz welcomed the European Union decision to condemn Iran and impose sanctions on it. This is an important step towards defanging the snake. And thank you to all our friends for their support and assistance, he posted on X. We must now stop Iran before it's too late. How important is the alliance between Iran and Russia? Dr. Shai Har-Zvi is a senior fellow and the head of the International and Middle East Arenas in the Institute for Policy and Strategy, the IPS, at Reichman University. Before joining the IPS, Dr. Har-Zvi held the position of Acting Director General in the Ministry of Strategic Affairs and served for 26 years in the IDF. In a Zoom conversation today hosted by the National Public Diplomacy Directorate, he analysed the Russian-Iran axis.
And why it is so important, the relation between Russia and Iran? Because when we are talking about the war in Ukraine, And when we're talking about the wars, the war in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas, Israel and Hezbollah, and Israel and Iran nowadays, actually, it's not only bilateral wars. Actually, we are talking about wars between camps, meaning on the one end, it is the American camp, which is led, of course, by the United States, and Israel and Ukraine are part of it. And of course, the Western countries and the moderate Arab countries are also. But on the other end, it is the radical axis, which is led by Iran in the Middle East, and the Hezbollah, Hamas, the militias, the Houthis are part of. And this axis is actually supported by Russia, China, and North Korea. So actually, it is a battle between two camps. And the outcome of the wars in Ukraine and in the Middle East will have a huge implication for the future of, I think, the Middle East and for the future of the global arena. And actually, of course, it was by coincidence, but President Biden, as you probably know, published yesterday an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, which in this op-ed, he actually talked directly about the war in Ukraine, about the war in the Middle East, about the war between Israel and Iran, and the fact that Russia on the one end and Iran on the other end are trying to eliminate two democratic countries, and it is in the core interest of the United States actually to stand with its allies in Ukraine and of course in the Middle East, which Israel, as according to President Biden, it is the best partner of the United States. And I think that the Iranian attack a few days ago actually has given Russia the opportunity to demonstrate its strategic cooperation with Iran, and that, as I said, it actually belongs to the radical axis. And few examples for that. Russia was actually unwilling to condemn the Iranian attack and actually hinted that Iran had the right to respond after the elimination of General Madavi in Damascus a few weeks ago. Furthermore, the Russian foreign ministry spokesperson Zakharova even mocked on our ambassador in Moscow, that our ambassador said that Russia should condemn Iran, and Zakharova saying that remind me when Israel condemned even once the Ukrainian attacks on Russia. So you don't remember, me too. Well, and what is the meaning of that? The meaning of that is very clear, that from the Russian point of view, that they stand with the Iran, they support Iran, and as I said, they were unwilling to condemn Iran for the brutal attack against Israel. Actually, as they did in the last few days and few weeks after the brutal terror attack of the October the 7th, when they were unwilling actually to condemn directly Hamas. And you know, the Russian response to the attack by Iran is actually in complete contradiction, not only to the response by the West, to the response of our partners in the West, but actually, for example, to the response of President Zelensky himself, which actually condemned the attack and said that it is the same as Iran attacks Israel. It is the same what Russia is doing to Ukraine for the last almost two and a half years. And I think that actually the deep gap between the Russian response and the Ukrainian response actually, as I said, reflects the global and regional conflict between the two camps. And this is why I think one of the main messages of my briefing, that we are talking about power struggle, confrontation between two camps in Europe and in the Middle East, that the outcome of those confrontation will have a huge impact of the new global order, or even the new order in the Middle East in the coming few years. And you know, when we are trying to dive into the relation between Russia and Iran, I think it might be that the turning point was in summer 2022, And why is that? Because in summer 2022, Iranians started to supply Russia UAVs, attacking UAVs. And from as far as we understand, this was a crucial turning point for Russia, because actually till then it suffered a lot of ammunition, a lot of weapon system, and the fact that Iranians were willing to supply Russia advanced UAVs, attacking UAVs, that Russia started to use them to attack civilian targets in Ukraine, to target energy infrastructure in Ukraine, actually made a huge impact on the war since then. And actually today, and furthermore, we've seen in the last few weeks that Russia increased its attacks against energy infrastructure in Ukraine. Actually, from the Russian point of view, they hope that by doing that, they will be able to achieve its goals. And they do it by using, inter alia, the Iranian UAVs. And furthermore, there are a lot of reports that Iran might supply Russia in the coming few weeks with ballistic missiles and other ammunition, and alongside the ammunition that Russia is getting from North Korea, for example, and the aid that Russia is getting from China. So actually, you see, we're standing behind Russia. This is the axis. This is the anti-American camp, which actually assists Russia to continue its war. And part of it, this is the same radical axis that actually fighting against Israel.
Dr. Shai Har-Tzvi, a senior fellow and the head of the International and Middle East Arenas in the Institute of Policy and Strategy at Reichman University. Last weekend, with the Iranian attack looming, many people were talking in terms of Armageddon. And here is the clash with Armageddon Time.
Get no supper tonight. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. And the battle is getting hard in this Irish Armageddon tonight. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. Remember to kick it off. No one will guide you along in time. Thank you.
you know, supper tonight. A lot of people sitting down by the light. A lot of people wanna get on, supper tonight. A lot of people wanna get on, just this tonight.
The Clash, Armageddon Time. The United Nations Security Council is due to vote tonight on a Palestinian bid for a full United Nations membership. Diplomats said a move that Israel's ally, the US, is expected to block because it would effectively recognise a Palestinian state. The 15-member council had initially been scheduled to vote on the measure on Friday. It will now vote tonight, the diplomats said. On day 195 of the war against Hamas, the IDF killed a senior figure in the Hamas interior security apparatus in a strike in Beit Hinun in the northern Gaza Strip. Israel Air Force aircraft targeted Yusef Rafik Shabbat, a security officer in the organization's military intelligence forces. IDF airstrikes also targeted a vehicle in which 10 terrorists were traveling. The IDF spokesperson said in a statement that in the past day, the Air Force has struck dozens of terror targets in the Gaza Strip. The World Food Programme says that for the first time, aid trucks entered the Gaza Strip via the Erez crossing in the northern part of the enclave. The organisation told CNN that 25 trucks carrying some 400 tonnes of assistance entered the strip. Israel agreed to open the crossing at the beginning of the month. Meanwhile, many Palestinian civilians capitalised on the warm weather to spend the day at the Deir al-Balah beach in the central Gaza Strip. Deir al-Balah is one of the few areas that the IDF has all but refrained from operating in so far in the Gaza Strip. Photos from Gaza Market show stalls with a variety of vegetables in stock, including tomatoes, potatoes, peppers, onions, along with staples such as eggs, spices and flour. Channel 12 quotes a Gaza photographer saying that the price of a 25-kilogram sack of flour has come down from 1,800 shekels at the peak of the war to 95 shekels. Qatar is reassessing its role as a mediator between Israel and Hamas, the country's prime minister said. Qatar has had a key role, along with Egypt and the US, in trying to secure a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas and the release of the Israeli hostages. But Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani said Doha has been exploited and abused and was being undermined by those trying to score political points. It's believed his references were to severe criticism from US congressmen. Negotiations on a hostage release deal. A senior Hamas official, Musa Abu Marzouk, says Hamas has not pulled out of the negotiations and the talks are not at an impasse. He told the Saudi network Al-Shark that Hamas believes that if the Israeli prime minister ceases to, quote, be stubborn and heeds what he termed the international conditions by holding fire, transferring aid, and allowing the return of displaced Gazans to their homes, it will be possible to solve the problems. The Hamas official for prisoner affairs, Zahar Jabarin, told the network Al-Mayadin that Hamas is demanding the release of 50 Palestinian prisoners for the release of every woman soldier hostage. He said, "Is it logical that Netanyahu agreed to free more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, including 500 sentenced to life, in exchange for Gilad Shalit, the captured IDF soldier, but now refuses to release in exchange for every female soldier 50 prisoners, and for every Israeli civilian 30 prisoners?" He was speaking to Al-Miadin. 133 hostages remain in Gaza. Not all of them are alive. Eitan Gonen, whose daughter Romy was abducted from the nature rave at Re'im, says he has no intention of marking the upcoming Passover holiday. "If my daughter is not sitting beside me," he told Khan, "there is no value in marking this day. That is the holiday of redemption from slavery to freedom. How can I quote from the Haggadah and sing and drink wine?" he said. As Passover approaches, families of hostages held in Gaza face the acute pain of their loved ones' absence. In a briefing hosted by Media Central, three grandchildren of elderly hostages spoke about their beloved grandfathers and issued a call for their and all the hostages' release. Among those who spoke was Talia Danzig, 18, of Tel Aviv, whose grandfather, Alex Danzig, aged 75, was abducted from kibbutz near Oz.
My grandpa kidnapped from his own house, from his own bed, during the massacre in kibbutz near Oz by Hamas terrorists. On October 7th, I managed to speak with him on the phone for the last time. Usually, he doesn't stop talking, but this time, he said only two words. Hamatzav murkav. The situation is complicated. I told him, let me know what's going on and we'll finish the call. I haven't heard his voice since then. 194 days has passed and my grandfather Alex is still kept in captivity in the worst camps you could possibly imagine. Released hostages that were held with my grandfather and went through situations with him, told me about the day they were kidnapped. They were three old people taken inside a van with the terrorist, guns pointing at them on their way to Gaza. Entered Gaza before they were taken to the tunnels under the ground. They were beaten by the angry and the furious crowd, and I'm careful with my words. They had to walk kilometers inside the tunnel while they are wounded and bruised all over their bodies. My grandfather is 75, old and ill man. He went through a hard heart attack and suffers from heart disease. He has to take his life-saving medications. We know he doesn't get them at all. He hardly gets food and hardly gets water. He can hardly sleep or breathe underground, where only darkness and despair and fear in his eyes. He doesn't deserve it. No human being deserves it. Alex Danzig is a man who has dedicated his life to investigate the Holocaust and the Jewish life in Europe before the war. His parents and sisters survived the Holocaust, and he grew up as a free Polish kid in his country. At the age of 7, the family moved to Israel. He became a history teacher and a farmer. You can ask him any question, and he will answer with a big smile and talk with passion. I think he really knows everything. I hope that his knowledge about the Holocaust helps him during his time in captivity. Released hostages that were held with him told about the history lessons that he gave them while they were in the captivity 150 days ago. We have no new information. We are getting closer to Passover, the holiday of freedom, and I'm not free. I'm not free as long as my grandfather is still there. I want to sit with him next to the Seder table. I want him to see that his whole big family at Near Oz survived the massacre. 13 family members, including my 15 little sister in them. He doesn't even know that he has people who are waiting to hug him again. I'm asking for your help. Let my grandfather go. Help us bring the light to his eyes. Help him be free again. The time is running out, and I don't really know if he's alive. We want our life back. We want our grandfather home. Let my grandpa go.
Talia Danzig, whose 75-year-old grandfather, Alex Danzig, of kibbutz near Oz, remains in Hamas activity. These are the stories making headlines at this hour. Washington reportedly agrees to an Israeli operation in Rafah under certain conditions if Israel does not strike Iran. Tehran threatens to review its nuclear doctrine. Washington and London impose new sanctions on Iran. The US is expected to veto a UN Security Council resolution tonight, recognizing Palestine as a UN member state. Qatar says it is reassessing its role as a mediator between Israel and Hamas. Hamas says it has not pulled out of the talks, and the weather seasonal tomorrow. Israeli athletes expected to compete in the upcoming Paris Olympic Games have been given a directive not to make statements on the situation in Israel or on the war. A reporter says the unprecedented directive is to stay mum until they complete their portion of participation in the Games. The chair of the Israel Olympic Committee, Yael Arad, says that athletes represent Israel in sport and the intention is for them to focus on their specialities. In the north, warnings of a suspected hostile aerial infiltration sounded earlier in the Western Galilee communities and earlier tonight in the Galilee Panhandle. Earlier, siren alerts sounded in Matula. Last night, around midnight, alerts sounded in the Panhandle communities. No injuries were reported, but there were landings of unidentified drones in the Matula area. The IDF overnight struck Hezbollah targets in South Lebanon. Two terrorists were killed in the area of Kfar Kila. The IDF said fire was also directed to remove threats in the sector. The Air Force continues to investigate yesterday's rocket and drone strike on a community centre in the northern border town of Arab al-Aramsheh, in which 14 soldiers and 4 civilians were injured. The local council head, Sally Said, told Khan that some of the residents are considering permanently leaving the community. In the Ramallah area town of Bitunia, Israeli security forces arrested an Islamic State supporter who planned an imminent attack. The wanted man tried to flee the building where he was and was arrested after a struggle. He was transferred to questioning by the Israel security agency Shin Bet. The Leo Beck Institute today hosted an online event, Echoes of Children's Survival, opening the Kestenberg Archive online, marking the launch of a digital access to the Kestenberg collection. It is an archive that documents the experiences of more than 1,500 child survivors and witnesses of Nazi persecution in over 20 countries. Ahead of the event, Dr. Eva Fogelmann, a psychologist, filmmaker and author who was deeply involved in the project, spoke to reporter Nomi Segal.
We're speaking with Dr. Eva Fogelmann ahead of the Leo Beck Institute's event, Echoes of Children's Survival, opening the Kestenberg Archive online. Tell us, first of all, a bit to frame it. What is the Kestenberg Archive?
Sure. The late Dr. Judith Kestenberg, who was a psychoanalyst, and her husband, Milton Kestenberg, who was an attorney who did a lot of reparation work with Holocaust survivors, started interviewing Holocaust child survivors. And today there are 1,500 interviews that are part of the Kestenberg Holocaust Child Survivor Archive that was digitized at Hebrew University in their oral history department, thanks to Dr. Sharon Kandiger. And it is a very, very unique archive, particularly because the project got started in 1981. At that time, there was one history professor, Dr. Yaffa Eliyah, who did very brief interviews with child survivors. Before that, you know, the general consensus was children did not remember, they don't have a sequential narrative to share, and therefore they were not interviewed like the older survivors. Also, we have to remember that child survivors did not get reparations from Germany because the Germans, once they interviewed a child survivor and they said, well, you know, when were you in the Warsaw Ghetto? And the child obviously couldn't remember or know any dates. They said, well, if you don't remember, therefore you weren't affected by the Holocaust. What is very unique about the Kestenberg Holocaust Child Survivor Archive is that these interviews were done early on, as I said, beginning in 1981. So for many of these interviews, this is the first time that the child survivors spoke about their experiences during the Holocaust. And once you tell a story over and over, now people are being interviewed over and over again, the story takes on its own life. And here, it was all very fresh. The other thing that's very unique about the archive is that the interviewers were all mental health professionals, and therefore they were able to also help the child survivor understand their feelings, their experiences. They helped them integrate their past, the Holocaust, and their future, so that they can have an integrated kind of self after, so that the interview also had a, it's not therapy, of course, but it had a therapeutic effect. What's also very unique about the archive is that most of the interviews are with Jewish Holocaust child survivors, but we also have interviews with Germans who were children during the Holocaust, and also with Poles who were also children during the Holocaust, and what effect and impact that had on them. The other thing that's unique about the archive is, of course, those children who were, you know, pre-verbal children obviously did not have their own narrative, because whatever it is they learned from, you know, from their parents or other caretakers who shared with them the story of what might have happened to them. But Dr. Judith Kestenberg developed a kinesthetic method, which is she got the children to imagine and to feel non-verbally and physically what it must have been like for them. And this was also a technique that was very helpful in that some of the children obviously had no connection to what they actually had experienced. And obviously, the interviewers had to be knowledgeable about the history, because the children remember in images. They don't remember like a narrative story, a sequential narrative. And so when you have an interviewer that knows the history, they could help the Holocaust child survivor tell their story in a more sequential order, piecing together their images of what happened and how they progressed from place to place.
These interviews took place in, as you mentioned, starting from the early 1980s. So how old were they when they took part in this project?
So I would say at that time they were probably in their 50s, figured they were like in their 50s. And most of the people are in their 80s and 90s today. So what I should say is that our definition of a Holocaust survivor, a child survivor, is anyone who was 13 or under at the start of persecution in their country. So that, for example, if we take Germany, January 30th, 1933, when Hitler became chancellor and all the laws against the Jews and losing their, you know, their jobs and some being incarcerated, even, believe it or not, as early as March of 1933. And if we talk about Austria, for example, we talk about when the Anschluss happened, which was March of 1938. If we talk about Poland, we're talking about September 1, 1939. So that, you know, so that, of course, the ages varied amongst this group depending on how many years of persecution they had.
They came from a range of countries and experiences. So was that, must have been reflected as well in what they related, if there were hidden children.
Yeah,
or
absolutely. There are, we have children who were, believe it or not, who survived Auschwitz, who survived Bergen-Belsen. We have children who were hidden in monasteries and convents, who were hidden with Christian families. We have children who had false identification papers and ran from, you know, one place to another. We had people, obviously, who fled the Asiatic part of Russia with their families. We have people who managed to escape after the Anschluss with the kinder transport and were in England and obviously from Germany. And there were a few from Czechoslovakia and Poland.
How was contact made with them initially?
Well, everything was sort of like a snowball kind of method. We heard about a child survivor, and we asked if they want to be interviewed. And then we had a gathering of Holocaust survivors. That was the second American gathering of Holocaust survivors in Philadelphia in 1984. And we had a table, and we asked people to sign up if they were child survivors, and then we had a meeting for them. And then the Kestenbergs and myself had meetings for Holocaust child survivors once a month, and then one person after another, you know, brought individuals to the group, and they would talk about their experiences, and then they would be asked if they want to be interviewed. Some were very hesitant. Some it took them many years before they were ready to give an interview. So as a result of the interviews and our meeting once a month, we then helped organize lots of other groups in other locales. The late Dr. Kestenberg was a member of the International Psychoanalytic Association, and so she met some psychoanalysts who were also child survivors themselves, and she got them to interview, you know, in Hungary and in France and in lots of other, in Australia. And then today we have an organization that meets on a yearly basis in both in the United States and abroad. And this is the World Federation of Holocaust Child Survivors and Their Descendants, which all stemmed from these interviews. So we also then had some people who felt that the child survivors were only seen as those who were incarcerated in a ghetto or in a concentration camp. And those who were hidden felt that they somehow didn't belong. People said, oh, you're not a survivor. You weren't in a ghetto or in a concentration camp. And so thanks to Miriam Abramowitz, who had done a film as if it was yesterday, she met a lot of, this was about the children who were hidden in Belgium. And she met lots of hidden children and wanted to, so she approached the Kestenbergs and myself to have a conference for hidden children. And we had a conference that 1,600 hidden children, but then others came as well, so that the hidden children for the first time also were able to develop an identity as hidden Holocaust child survivors, rather than feeling like, you know, because they weren't in a camp or a ghetto, therefore they can't, you know, they can't consider themselves Holocaust survivors.
How did you yourself become involved in this, and what has that experience been like for you?
Sure. I first started in 1976, myself and Bella Savarin, who lives in Israel now and is involved with the Counseling Center for Women. We started groups for the second generation of Holocaust survivors, and then occasionally people approached us and said, you know, I don't know if I belong. You know, I went through the war as a very small child, but my parents survived. And so I don't know if I belong. So I said, sure, come to the group. And so that's when I began to have a consciousness about those who were children during the Holocaust. And I also did a group at Hebrew University as well in 1978. And at that time in Israel, they thought that I was bringing an American phenomenon to Israel, that Israeli second generation were not affected. But a lot of that has since changed. And what happened is that so my work as second generation became, you know, well known as a result of an article that Helen Epstein wrote in the Sunday New York Times magazine. And then after Judith Kestenberg started interviewing child survivors, I had invited her to a conference. I organized a conference for the second generation in 1979 in New York, and Judith Kestenberg had also done a lot of work with the second generation of Holocaust survivors through the American Psychoanalytic Association, which is where I met her at annual meetings. And then she approached me to come and work with her on interviewing child survivors. And in terms of how it affected me, well, I feel very gratified that I have been able to give a voice to those people who were voiceless. And, you know, at times it's, you know, obviously very difficult work, and because of, you know, what they experienced. You know, you have some child survivors who did not even know their name. They didn't know their parents. They didn't know when they were born, had no, you know, no identity, had to create an identity. Some child survivors were still living with the tremendous fears or coping in the way that they had coped during the Holocaust. So there have been, you know, emotionally difficult moments in interviewing these individuals, and also my work as a therapist in working with Holocaust survivors, adults and children.
Well, certainly it's very important work, and especially now with it's going online, it will continue to be testimony.
Absolutely. And what was quite incredible is that the social work school at Hebrew University is now using materials of how other children survived such massive trauma and what helped them cope. And the social work school at Hebrew University prepared the children who were hostages when they came back. And they learned from how the children cope before in preparation for bringing them out. So I think the archive and scholar, you know, this is the archive has, since it's been at Hebrew University for a couple of years, has been used by quite a few scholars. We have books that have come out. That have been edited by myself and Dahlia Offer and Sharon Kanziger. And we hope that this archive will be used to learn from how children coped with such severe trauma for our current situation.
Dr. Eva Fogelman. Now, Mashina, Shlachli Malach, send me an angel.
שיש פה כל ה...
machine. Google has announced it has fired 28 employees after a series of protests against the tech giant's contract to provide the Israeli government and military with cloud computing and AI services. The news came a day after 9 Google workers were arrested for trespassing charges after staging a sit-in at offices in New York and California. President Yitzhak Herzog says Israel's strong, independent, professional and untethered judiciary buys its honour throughout the free world and serves as a defensive shield against those who wish to harm our right to defend ourselves. Speaking at a swearing-in ceremony for new judges at the president's residence in Jerusalem, Herzog said Israel needs broad agreement, and that includes the judiciary. At this moment, we all need to pledge to make an effort and to accommodate one another and even to compromise a little bit in order to find the golden path. 36 judges took the oath of office. The Bezeq telephone company has reported a surge in the number of Israelis who have asked to install landline telephones in their homes. The surge in demand was initially sparked by Haifa Mayor Yona Yahav, who said at a city council meeting that local residents would be advised to install landlines in their homes and bomb shelters given the current security situation, so as to be fully prepared should cellular networks be knocked out of commission. The biggest uptick in average weekly demand was recorded in Haifa, where requests for landlines were 364% higher than they had been in the preceding 8 weeks. The record high was recorded last Wednesday, which saw a 791% increase in demand relative to the preceding 8 weeks, a peak that might have been the product of the escalating tensions ahead of the failed Iranian missile attack. Demand for landlines rose elsewhere in Israel as well and peaked on April the 8th with a 206% increase in demand relative to the preceding 8 weeks. Now Lior Narkis and more with Ein Li Shum Sikui, I Have No Chance.
שום דבר לא בא לי טוב, כביש נמרח אני לא קרוב, אפילו לא בערך. תגידי את שומעת אותי, קורא לך.
למה לך אז לעזוב? בסך הכל היה פה טוב. מה תרצה שעשה? שלא תלך.
ולא אכלתי כבר שבוע, הלב שלי נשאר תקוע, סתם עברתי רק לראות אם יש אצלך מישהו אחר. לא רואים לי את העיניים, איך דמעות זרמים של מים, בלעדייך אין לי שום סיכוי. לילה שוב הופך ליום, כאב תופס את המקום, הלב שלי על רטט, תגידי את שומעת אותו, קורא לך.
שום דבר לא בא לך טוב, מה לא עשיתי שתהיה קרוב, לשבת על הים וזה סרט שימשוך שעות, תשקר לי ותצעק עליי רק לא שתיקה. ולא אכלתי כבר שבוע, הלב שלי נשאר תקוע, סתם עברתי רק לראות אם אצלך יש משהו.
שבוע, הלב שלי נשאר תקוע,
סתם עברתי רק לראות אם אצלך יש משהו אחר.
The weather outlook slightly cooler tomorrow, turning seasonal. Saturday, slightly hotter, particularly inland and on the hills. Sunday, continuing seasonal. Monday, Saturday night, hotter, particularly inland and on the hills. Temperatures forecast for tonight and tomorrow. Jerusalem 16 to 23, Tel Aviv 20 to 23, Haifa 19 to 19, Tzfat 17 to 20, Tiberias 17 to 28, Beersheva 19 to 27, and in Eilat from 22 tonight, rising to 33 degrees Celsius tomorrow. Another look at the main headlines at this hour. Washington reportedly agrees to an Israeli operation in Rafah under certain conditions if Israel does not strike Iran. Tehran threatens to review its nuclear doctrine. Washington and London impose new sanctions on Iran. The United States is expected to veto a United Nations Security Council resolution tonight recognizing Palestine as a UN member state. Qatar says it is reassessing its role as a mediator between Israel and Hamas. Hamas says it has not pulled out of the ceasefire talks, and the weather, seasonal tomorrow. That's the news. Join us tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on Kan Reka, the foreign languages channel of the Israel Public Broadcasting Corporation. This is Mark Weiss wishing you good evening and shalom, and Shabbat shalom from Jerusalem.